Time for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy, London 104.4 FM. Yeah, residents.
And that's the end of the show for today. As Max has, is the saliva in your mouth? Is it frozen from the cold outside?
Oh, it's nippy out there. Very nippy. As the consequences
of the sun, of the Earth's orbit around the sun. So my God, it's been a very busy week. So there's the Palestine has been upgraded at the UN.
They got the upgrade.
They got the upgrade, and apparently, you know, I saw like the immediate headlines as like shock, surprise, blah blah blah, and I thought, really, was it a surprise? And then I read a little bit more, and I found out that in fact Israel was surprised that many European countries either voted to accept Palestine as a, you know, this upgraded status, or abstained, like the UK chickened out. But they did abstain. They didn't vote against it. Israel had thought a lot of European countries like Germany and the UK would vote against it. Instead, it was France, I guess, who came out first and said that they were actually going to vote for it. And part of it, the reason for this change, was that the Gaza assault. They just saw this, brutal assault, and just France decided we've got to upgrade the situation for Palestine to, you know, be at the table and start negotiating for real.
This has been a sea change, I guess, you know, after decades of moving in one direction. And it seems we see this also in politics. You know, in the U.S., the right wing has, with that loss to Obama, really has gone into a sustained decline. The culture wars, as they call them, they've lost. You know, a couple of their top priorities are dead. Then you've got the Israeli-Palestine situation. That's a pretty significant change, turnaround. You've got the only thing that hasn't really radically changed economically, I'd say, is that the various economies are still clinging to this idea that the collapse of 2008 will be nursed back to health by this continued drip feed of money creation, so that's still happening. But there are some wild cards, Stacy. It's hard to predict what is going to be the trigger point, the flashpoint, the straw to break the global camel's back, and it looks increasingly more like it could be Japan. Yep.
Yeah, I see their name being floated more and more often in the headlines. So, you know, they have the largest debt in the world. And you wouldn't know that because the debt is basically to itself, its citizens. So all those Japanese government bonds and the quantitative easing they've been doing for the last 20 years has been financed by the savings of the Japanese citizen. But that savings is now depleted after over 20 years of deflation and a declining economy and stock market and housing market. And now not only are they about to have to go onto the international market to finance their debt, unless they just start buying their own. And then they've always been able to survive because they've always been an export nation, and now there's a deficit there, right?
Right, the trade deficit. Now it's happened. This is after really 20, 25, 30 years of being an export powerhouse. They have to import more than they export. And a very interesting statistic that's been widely quoted is that the sale of adult diapers now exceeds the sale of diapers for children. And this tells you that demographically, the country is going to be in a bit of a conundrum because, of course, to fund the pension schemes and the welfare schemes, you need that each generation has to pay for the previous generation. So if, in fact, you don't have enough of the new generation to pay off the older generation, then that, which has been described as a quote-unquote good Ponzi scheme, but it works like a Ponzi scheme where the people leaving are funded by the people coming into it. If there aren't enough people coming into it, then that scheme collapses. They're becoming a net importer, so they no longer have the ability to hide the fact that their domestic debts are growing and now the biggest in the world, over 220% of GDP. And now this new fellow coming in, there's an election, I think it's December 16. He has openly stated that he wants to force the Bank of Japan into printing a fresh quadrillion in yen to crash the yen. They call it inflation targeting, and to boost those exports. But I think you must refer to Jim Rickard's currency wars to get a taste of what this means, because, of course, this will set up a global round of devaluations as people try to devalue their way out of their growth. One thing is clear, Stacey, is that growth, if you recall, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, there was this idea of decoupling where China was going to assume the role of global financial engine for the world, and the BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Well, we're seeing slowdowns in Brazil, which was on the Financial Times today. China is definitely slowing down. India is now slowing down. Russia, you know, okay, they maybe not slowing down so much, but they're not as big an economy. But the BRIC nations are in retreat. So now there is no country in the world that's growing, except, of course, for Iceland, because they stood up to the bankers. But unfortunately, their economy is only worth a few hundred billion, so they're not going to. Yeah, they're not going to pull they're not going to be the engine pulling the global economy, even though by rights they should be.
Actually, I'm going to Google this, but I'm pretty sure Iceland's GDP is 13 billion. Let's see. $14 billion.
Wow. That's like a 95% collapse from the pre-collapse.
And how much cash on hand does Apple have, for example? Over $100 billion.
Right, $130 billion in cash. There's almost a $600 billion company. Well, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg is worth, I think, $10 billion. So Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, almost. Well, if he borrowed some money, he could buy Iceland.
You know, talking about the BRICS nations and the collapsing economies and stuff, I saw an article, I think it was in Bloomberg, I don't know, but it was like, just shows you this this new global dynamic and this new sort of oligarchy. They said 13.5% of all property sales in Italy are to Russians.
Mm. Well, a friend of ours just came back from Thailand, and 2 weeks in Thailand, he said that it was just wall-to-wall Russians. So, right. And of course, in London, the front page of the Financial Times today said that the new £1 million scheme that gives people a fast track to citizenship if they put up £1 million and they invest it in the economy here in the UK, which includes real estate, this has drawn in a very high number of Russians and Chinese and other folks. So Britain definitely has an immigration problem, but it's not coming from poor people. It's coming from the rich people who are jacking up the price of real estate in London and totally skewing the market across the entire country.
Well, everybody's offering those schemes now, all these collapsing economies. They're looking to what London's done to survive the global collapse, and it's that sort of thing. So Spain openly, so they introduced a new policy. It's basically you could become a citizen close to it if you buy property just worth 160,000 euros. And the spokesperson, the Minister of the Interior, said, well, they're trying to attract Russians and Chinese. And now Latvia has also introduced one because their economy has collapsed. And that's for 70,000 euros. So everybody's like, it's a spiraling down, because remember, before the crisis, during the boom times, a few countries were offering similar programs. Portugal still has theirs on the book, and that's 400,000 euro property you need to buy to get on their fast track. But pretty soon, I'm sure, Portugal will have it for 50,000.
Well, I asked this question on this show 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Why don't countries offer non-voting citizenships for $50,000, $100,000 as a way to boost their reserves, you know? And a country like Iceland or Ireland could easily bank $1 billion by just selling non-voting citizens. I mean, it's particularly in Iceland, where 98% of those non-voting passports they sell will be to people that never visit Iceland because it's too freaking cold. But they just keep the cash. And the demand for this type of thing is growing exponentially. But this is what's happening. We see it in the market. So the countries are now now competing with each other to offer these economic residencies and economic citizenships, as I figured they would, because it's an absolute easy way to just book some cash. And the prices are coming down. So I think before, these are residencies. There's only two places that offer a passport for cash that I know of. One is Nevis St. Kitts for $250,000. Dominica, which is a similar island nation, offers it for about $100,000. And I would imagine we're going to see one of these countries compete in that arena as well and just offer a straight up and down passport, cash on delivery for $50,000. And that's true globalization that we need to offset the nefarious globalization of the multinationals.
Well, the interesting thing I think about the Latvia one is there's also been a map released this week, because, you know, the Doha round of the climate change talks are out, and they showed a map of Europe of where, over the next 50 years, where it's going to be. Basically, Spain, Portugal is the worst hit. Okay, it's going to be just unlivable, uninhabitable. Same with much of Italy, south of Spain, most of Spain, the south of France. But actually, on the positive side, nations which will actually benefit, a big one is Russia, but also Scandinavia and all that Baltic region. So Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia actually will have positive from it. And go ahead, screech in the comment section. Go ahead. It's global cooling. Well, place your money where your mouth is, dudes. Go buy a property in Portugal, okay? Or Spain. Lots of empty properties there. Mm-hmm. I, however, would think Latvia would be a good place to buy a property, because there's lots of, beautiful space there, and it's on the Baltic, and it's going to be in a region not only lots of rail, to get to all the agricultural land in Russia. And it might be a good place, because it says that they say they're going to benefit from climate change.
Yeah, I think that's another trend that is in this period reversing the climate chaos, climate change deniers. Mm-hmm. I think are now rapidly losing their population, because that and the abortion issue for this recent presidential election in America were huge losers. A lot of people cite the fact that the Republican parties were full of climate change deniers and folks who were against women's rights as the reason why they lost so stupendously in the last election. And so it's no longer a vote getter to pretend as though man-made climate change isn't causing these huge economic social disruptions around the world. So that's also another change, sea change. Everything is changing except for this idea that you can restart an economy plagued by debt by increasing debt. That's the one thing that the G20 nations are still clinging on to. And certainly in the UK, although in the UK, Mervyn King, to his credit, said that the additional quantitative easing is losing its punch. There's some stories today in the paper from economists saying, look, quantitative easing is destroying the insurance industry because it's making the insurance industry model unviable, because you need interest rates to be 4 or 5% at a minimum to make that industry work. And if you lose the insurance industry, you don't have private property. And if you don't have private property, you don't have capitalism. So people are beginning to understand that interest rates at close to 0% is incredibly destructive. So that means that there are at least some talk about the fact that interest rates have to be normalized back up to the 4 or 5% range. But they don't want to do it, obviously, because it would crush the real estate market. And you see the real estate market, they're offering mortgages at sub 2% here in the UK. And the mortgage bankers are competing to get people into this market with sub 2% mortgages. And, you know, go back to when Bradford and Bingley and Northern Rock were offering 120% mortgages for new purchases. We said flat out that this was a bubble about to burst and there would be a huge real estate crash, which is exactly what happened 12 months later. I would say that this race to the bottom offering sub 2% mortgages in an economy which is being artificially supported with quantitative easing marks another top in this real estate market.
Well, importantly to our American audience listening to this is, yes, it's 1.99% mortgage rates for 2 years. So you're making a bet, you're speculating that in 2 years' time, interest rates won't have reset to 5 or 6 or 7%. That there won't be a collapse in the bond market, that everything is going to be okay in 2 years' time, and that your interest rates are still going to be that low, so you can reset. I mean, I was seeing that in the U.S., most people go on fixed rates for like 30-year mortgages, and it's something like 3% for 30 years. Like that, okay, that's something that's pretty good. But these crazy tracker mortgages, this is a uniquely more European sort of crazy thing.
Well, in the UK, they have the tracker mortgages. They're mostly, the mortgages are tracker mortgages. You're right, that's an introductory rate. It's only good for a couple of years. The economy itself is being artificially boosted with quantitative easing. So it's like taking steroids if you're an athlete, or if you're if you're a vegetable in the hospital and you're kept alive with being pumped, you know, artificial heart and lung machines, you know, the second you pull the plug, you die, right? So this is an economy being artificially kept alive using the apparatus of quantitative money transfusions, which are you can't continue. Now, it's funny that in the U.S., with the current chatter in the failed economist class, like the Paul Krugmans, are that, you see, it worked. The U.S. economy grew, and we didn't have inflation. Completely ignoring the fact that the Fed's balance sheet went from $800 billion to over $3 trillion, and now they're talking about taking it to $10 trillion. Now, that's the same thing as saying, like, a vegetable in the hospital who's in a brain-dead coma, who is being on life support after 3 or 4 years, saying, you see, look, the patient didn't die. It's still breathing. We succeeded. Well, the patient's still brain-dead. Now, if you remove the life support system, you have a corpse. You have a zombie, and the zombies... In the UK, 10% of all companies are zombies. That's 160,000 companies are making money just to pay the interest on the debt. They're not retiring any debt. And the zombie population is increasing. Japan is a zombie country. It's been described as a zombie country for 20 years. They're about to go into fatal cardiac financial arrest. So now we see, I think, after all these sea changes with Israel-Palestine, with climate change, all this, finally, after decades of wrong thinking, people are swinging the other way. We're at that point now where economically it'll be figured out that, you know what, this depression that people have been trying to avoid is here.
the claps is here. So what else did we do this week? We covered the Mark Carney story, your new head of the Bank of England. And it was really quite interesting, the juxtaposition of the two headlines. There was a headline in The Guardian that read, Congo rebels surround central bank in Goma. And then there was a headline, Goldman Sachs takes over Bank of England. Of course, they also have the European Central Bank. They run Italy. They run Greece. So they've really got Europe, which presumably means once the U.S. appoints a new head of the Treasury and head of the Fed, there'll be J.P. Morgan guys to seem fair and balanced.
Yes, it's a clean sweep. And today in the Financial Times, they're saying that Canada, you know, Mark Carney, the crisis in Canada happened back in 1993. You know, Canada, the Canadian banks were going out of business. And the country completely redid the banking system. And they essentially nationalized the banking system. So the banks are not, you know, competing. They're owned pretty much by the state. And then Mark Carney came along, and there was no fallout from the 2008 crisis because the banks had already been completely recapitalized from the previous crisis. So he wasn't really participating in the 2008 crisis. But now in Canada, there's this huge real estate bubble that's popping, and cheap money is about to become more expensive money. So he is leaving at a propitious time for himself because now the fallout from the policies will not be on his watch. Now he comes to the UK, steps into the Bank of England, and you know, there's a lot of you know, it's interesting to me that these central bankers can have no national allegiance. Doesn't anyone kind of find that interesting? In that it's pretty clear that if you can pull a central banker out of Canada and stick him into Britain, that who's being served there is a global banking system, not the banking system of the country. So when Mark Carney comes in and starts making changes to support the global banking system to the detriment of British people, you know, people are going to ask that question. Well, why is this Canadian banker here to begin with? Why are our interests being subverted by this global banking system?
Yeah, but that's because you're part of the American empire. Americans don't run their empire like that. So the Brits are used to that. I have lots of friends here whose parents used to run part of the British Empire. You know, they were born and raised in parts of Africa, which were under British rule, or parts of the Middle East. This whole Palestine-Israel thing, of course, is part of the British Empire. So, you know, empire. Lots, huge swathes of earth were run by these Brits who were sent there to run that area. So they're kind of used to that sort of system here of empire, imperialism. So yes, to put it in that context, there's an imperial sort of sense to how we are being run. Most people seem quite happy with it. They just go about their daily lives and don't seem to care. But I saw a piece in Slate magazine comparing what's going on right now in these our Western democracies to the lead up to the end of Rome as a democracy, as a republic. And so once Caesar just changed it to you know, a dictatorship, the population didn't care so much because of the lead up during that time. There was basically during a lead up to an election, there would be so much money poured in to Rome to buy up the politicians, to pay the graft, that they noted in the lead up to one election, interest rates doubled because there was so much money and so much inflation going on as so much money poured into Rome. So in the decades leading to the collapse, there was there were basically, you know, the population was so appalled by the graft and the bribery and the buying of politicians that, you know, one guy trying to become a politician or a senator would vow to introduce laws to against it. And of course, they would be elected and then they would introduce this law. And then they, I think they, it was Cicero, I think they used a case of one guy who passed this law. And then the very first person found guilty of it was his close friend. So he said, we absolve him of any guilt. So the population became just so disgusted that nothing ever changed. And it was just bought and owned politicians. So they might as well have a dictatorship. They might as well have a system, a one-party rule like China. Maybe this is what people, maybe this is the barbarian at the gate of what people will accept and tolerate because they know our systems are so corrupt.
Right. Well, you mentioned there that there's so much money flowed into it that interest rates doubled. Mm-hmm. Now, that's called inflation. And they were on the gold and silver standard at the time. And to deal with the inflation, interest rates went up. Now, why don't we see interest rates rising today? Because of all the money that's flooded into these systems and these multi-billion dollar elections, multi-hundred billion dollar bailouts, and trillion dollar budgets. Because all of that inflation is on the balance sheet of the central banks. In the shadow banking system, which is now $67 trillion, they just revised it upward by $6 trillion. On the multi-trillion dollar balance sheet of the Fed, the ECB, and Bank of England, and other central banks. And that's where the inflation is. And the economists are telling us that it doesn't matter, that you can grow the shadow banking system to infinity without any consequences whatsoever. But that's completely false because of a few things. Number one, savers have been destroyed. So you've wiped out an entire generation through financial oppression. Number two, the insurance industry, which needs higher interest rates to operate, is being wiped out. So you're killing the golden goose of capitalism. No insurance, no private property. Number three, you have misallocation of investing with 0% interest rates. So in the case of global warming and climate change, 20 years ago, some bright folks could have decided to fund some flood barriers in New York City and raise the money and saved $60, $70 billion worth of damage with a $16 billion flood barrier. But instead, the status quo that wants to ignore some of these obvious dangers and focus on financialization and transactionalization and neoliberalization continue to float the Ponzi scheme. And that's the problem when you don't have a sesterce, when you don't have hard money backing your currency, when you live in a fantasy land, when you have Paul Krugman, you know, deciding how many angels can dance on the head of a pin of quantitative easing. And the ultimate comeuppance in this will happen quite suddenly, like a massive flood of jacking up interest rates. But by then, you know, all these other changes are happening. People in the Mideast is changing, people's perceptions changing, the electoral map is changing, social contracts are changing. Everything's changing right now except this belief in the tooth fairy of money printing. But that is also going to change. And when it changes, this is going to be quite a shocking moment for folks.
You know, going back to the Israel-Palestine thing and merging it with this story about global financial collapse, or at least the end of one thing and the beginning of another, is when we were at the Kelkonomics Festival, we hung out for a bit with Dmitry Orlov, who, you know, wrote that brilliant piece, The Collapse Gap, comparing the collapse in Russia to what will happen to the U.S. And, you know, he's Russian-born. He's from from Russian-occupied Finland, that bit over there on the border near St. Petersburg. So he, one of the things he said that surprised me in this, so Kilkenomics early November, he said, Israel is just an outpost of Russia. It's actually Russia is more important to Israel than the U.S., and at the end of the day, when the U.S. will disappear, it'll be Russia that is the one that supports, basically finances, and it's just an outpost of Russia. And that's why, sure enough, right after that, you know, you saw like Netanyahu over there in Russia had to fly to Russia to meet with Putin because Putin had admonished them for something. But then this whole, during this Gaza crisis, okay, it was Russia Today's Abby Martin who went hard after Russia, after Israel. Just, you know, there was just the really great reporting about what they were doing and the war crimes they were committing in Gaza, so that some of the AIPAC people called her an anti-Semite and said Russia Today was an anti-Semite. Anyway, it became a big story, and the deputy prime minister of Israel then came on to the show and was apologizing to Russia Today, apologized to Abby Martin. And it was interesting to see that dynamic so soon after Dmitry Orlov had pointed it out that I hadn't ever even considered. It always seems like a U.S.-British story.
Well, I guess because of the immigration patterns during World War II, we end up with a lot of Russians in Israel.
That's true. Well, we're also going to find out their role with this polonium 210, because I know Arafat was exhumed this week, and they took some, you know, fragments, bone fragments, to see if he had polonium 210. Now, that was one of the theories at the time, that Litvinenko was killed with polonium 210 right here in central London. One of the, you know, everybody's speculating who did it, who was responsible. And one of the theories was that somehow Israel was behind it at the time. That was one of the theories. So it does change everything if the same thing was used to kill both of them.
Well, I'm sure if that's the conclusion, they'll deny it. And then the American media machine will support that denial. So that's the most powerful media machine.
Well, the interesting thing, though, is it's France is behind this, the exhuming of Arafat. So they were also one of the first European nation to break and say, we're going to go behind Palestine. But anyway, so you just see a lot of ruptures in the global, you know, obviously the financial collapse, what we said at the time when 2008 on BBC World's The Oracle, we were saying at the time, and here on Resonance 104.4 FM, we were also saying that this collapse was the end of the U.S. empire and the shift east. So this is another bit I read this week, was they were comparing post-collapse, or since 2007, 2008, what the world looks like now. And exports from Europe, for example, they said, are down 20% still from 2008 peak. America is, their exports are now up 9%. But China's is up 20% since the 2008 peak. So they're higher in exports since 2008. And where it's mostly going, almost all of it, is to Asia. So their most important trading partner is actually other Asian countries and not the U.S. It's multiple times more to Asia than to the U.S. So there's this, you know, Asian region, this Asian bloc is developing, you know, in a crouching tiger kind of way. Nobody is looking over there. Nobody, we're so, most of the media is obsessed with ourselves over here, while over there, things are developing. William Banzai 7, by the way, also says this. He's over there. He lives in Hong Kong. And he says you have to come here because it's a completely different thing. It's something different from what's going on in the West.
Right. Well, you know, evidence of this, of course, is that the U.S. dollar 20 years ago was 75% of global trade. And now it's down to 60%. It's below 60%, so it's sinking. Once it gets below 50%, then technically you can't really say it's the world reserve currency anymore. You've got different fragments of the of currency blocks emerging, and this will necessitate the need to benchmark these various currencies against something with universal value. Central banks are buying gold. That's right. But don't tell the Americans. They don't want to hear that.
Another story I saw along this line was the Middle East, of course, has been an important story since oil was discovered there 50, 60, 70 years ago, since the first oil wells were drilled and started exporting out of Saudi Arabia, is where their exports are going, where Saudi Arabian exports are going. So who, therefore, is going to be the most important client, and that's China. So as the U.S. becomes more energy independent, you know, for some reason they've decided they'd rather have cancer and tainted meat and stuff with fracking. That's their choice. That's what they want to do. And it's USA, USA, USA. But really, you have to look into this. I was just reading before you came back from coffee is this amazing story about all the dead cattle across North Dakota and all these places with fracking. In Pennsylvania as well, these stillborn calves and this just a nightmare. All these fracking fluids are entering the food chain, actually, because these the cattle is being tainted. But in terms of geopolitics, you know, China is importing more and more oil from Saudi Arabia as they go looking for new buyers for their export market.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the petrodollar is breaking down. You know, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, which took over in 1971 when the U.S. closed the gold window. So that's breaking up. Mid East is totally breaking up. And what's going on in Egypt? They're having a new revolution already? That didn't take long.
Yeah, well, you know, our friend Bicycle Mark is there. He's in Tahrir Square. And apparently what happened is, you know, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went there, met with Morsi, and, you know, the new president-elect of Egypt. And, like, the following day, almost, he just introduced this new dictatorial law which gave him more powers than Mubarak ever had. And, of course, hundreds of thousands immediately poured out into the streets and came into Tahrir Square demanding his ouster. And Bicycle Mark said that all of them agreed. The word there in the Tahrir Square street was that it was Hillary Clinton had given him the go-ahead to go full dictator.
Oh, right. Well, that's interesting. I guess the situation is quite volatile. Hillary Clinton, what the prognosis is, he claims he's just going to hold on to it for a short period of time. We've heard that before. That never is the case, is it? They always hold on to it for more. And that border, you know, we were talking about Israel before. So there's an Egypt-Israeli-Palestine border that is open now, right? Noam Chomsky just crossed over into Palestinian territories for the first time ever, even though he's been writing about it for decades. So that border is open. Clearly, a lot of folks are don't like that, right?
Yeah, that's the Gaza border, the Egyptian border with Gaza. And the Egyptians control that, not Israel. Well, you know, Israel has a relationship with the Egyptian military that goes back through Mubarak. But, you know, in terms of Clinton meeting with Morsi and then dictatorship coming in, this is exactly what John Perkins would say is that was economic hitman situation. You know, they always get visited immediately by the U.S. The empire tells them what to do. Either they get whacked or they abide by what they want. So the Gaza border, yeah, I mean, a part of the thing is that Morsi, of course, his base is the Muslim Brotherhood, who have a close relationship with Hamas. So, you know, part of the populist thing is to open that border and allow more to go back and forth. But the military is still like Mubarak guys who are very close to Israel. So who knows? It's all part of the geopolitics. But you said occupied territories. I think with this UN vote, it's now the occupied state. So Palestine now becomes in the UN no longer the Palestinian occupied territories, but the occupied state of Palestine.
Right. And the response from Israel, I believe, is that they're going to build 3,000 more settlements on the illegally. So they seem to be doubling down on a trend that it doesn't seem to be going in their favor. I don't, unless I'm missing something. I mean, they've got something like 200 nuclear weapons, and maybe they're going to try to grab a few countries in the region or something. I don't know.
Well, one thing I noticed is, you know, on Twitter and the social media, I think this is part of the problem of what's happened to the U.S. empire, to the British empire, to the Israeli situation. The you know, the power structure we have, is it's harder and harder to control the message, because, you know, you could always get the Guardian and the Telegraph and stuff to write what you want. And we've seen now with, you know, Petraeus, the general in charge of Afghanistan, was sleeping with this woman who then wrote a book about how fantastic and heroic and this general has saved the Afghanistan and that kind of stuff. But now, you know, I've noticed over the last few years, you could see in Twitter that people you wouldn't normally expect are starting to see the truth about the situation. For example, what was happening in Gaza. And even though the IDF had this, you know, a social media, somebody in charge of social media, and they have a Twitter account, and but Hamas, the military wing of Hamas, the Al-Aqsa Brigade, they also have a Twitter account, and they were out there tweeting through the whole thing, but in a more kind of humorous, spunky way, and actually responding to IDF sort of tweets saying, "What are you talking about? You're not winning this. We are." You know, yeah. It was quite amusing. But they said, for example, the Washington Post did the Twitter wars between IDF and Hamas. And they said, well, you know, IDF has more followers, but if you look at the actual how the social media works, is the Hamas guys were being retweeted more often. Mm. So they had a bigger impact.
Yeah. Well, speaking of social media and Twitter, apparently it's omitted from the Levinson inquiry on media, which can you give a synopsis about what's going on there? It's a typically British long-winded fudge, and I'm not clear what's happening, but I know you have more experience in this. What exactly is the status of that?
It's so complicated, and it is like a big lovey sort of thing. Basically, Levinson decided that some members of the media wreaked havoc, and therefore we need to end press freedom. And I likened it to what has happened with the financial crisis, is some bankers, i.e. Lloyd Blankfein, Jamie Dimon, sold fraudulent securities around the world. The world has gone bankrupt. There are too many derivatives. All, you know, the crimes they committed, these few guys wreaked havoc. So we all must pay. And this is what's happening. It's like they're saying, but it's going to be this weird self-regulating body, they said, to propose. And yet it was backed by law. So there will be some, it's all fakakta. It's all crazy. But of course, they can't include Twitter because it's a U.S.-based company. The U.S. no longer enforces U.K. libel laws. It's a weird, the only thing they can do is block Twitter from being in this country. So, you know, that's at the point where they are, really.
So if I'm an editor at a newspaper in Britain, does it change my day-to-day at all?
Well, David Cameron said he won't introduce these, Levinson, because he said, suppress further press freedom. These are just, you know, Levinson could only make suggestions, and it's up to the government to introduce them. David Cameron has said he won't introduce it, but Labour and Lib Dems are saying they want it. And leading the charge are people like, J.K. Rowling, who, she's been harassed by the press, so she wants these, more regulation against them from being able to, you know, chase anybody, or, you know, so it becomes a thing where, yes, they do harass individuals, celebrities involved with sex scandals in particular. But you know what happens is it just gets applied to normal, you know, genuine criminals, like what we saw with the Trafurgar affair. So that company that was dumping toxic waste literally just off the shore in Ghana, off of Africa. And the libel laws here prevented them from being able to report it. I think it was WikiLeaks had released the documents proving that they were dumping toxic waste. And the only way it was even able to be reported here was because some MP read it in Parliament, where they had parliamentary privilege. So it gets used by and abused, these sort of laws. Anytime you introduce these new regulations, with the cost of any legal situation here being exorbitant, it's only the very wealthy and powerful that use these weapons against everybody.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I keep reading that Britain has the freest press in the world, or one of the freest presses in the world, but that's not true at all. It's one of the most restricted presses in the world. Look at the Jimmy Savile story as a case in point. Nobody would report on Jimmy Savile's pedophilia for years because they feared he would sue them under British libel law. So that is not freedom of speech, is it? And you have real victims, real people got traumatized because of those libel laws that in the UK that are favor the wealthy and the powerful. That it's not a free press by any stretch of the imagination. I don't see how they can get away with calling it a free press.
And yet, I think because the UK is no longer empire, there's no real powerful people here. All the very genuine powerful people are in Washington, D.C. And so even though the U.S. has the First Amendment and freedom of speech there, the media is way less robust in the U.S. than here. At least the press is a little bit better, but the citizens themselves have less rights to say things and call people names and challenge people on their facts without fear of being sued for libel. In the U.S., that doesn't happen.
Right. Well, in the U.S., it's a question of distribution. So I can say that's why we do our shows outside of the U.S., because if we did the shows that we do, challenging banks and pointing out bank fraud, we could do it in the U.S. if we wanted to, but we wouldn't get any distribution. We wouldn't get any distribution on any TV network or any mainstream media whatsoever. We do it outside of the U.S. because we get distribution on various international TV satellite networks that go all over the world because we get distribution. So in the U.S., it's freedom of speech, yeah, but you don't get any distribution. Here, you get distribution. You get a robust media. You have the left wing and the right wing, and they have lots of left-right debates, and it's all very robust. But it's not free in the sense that it's free of odious libel laws that favor the rich and powerful. So that's the trade-off.
That's true. That's the trade-off. So this week on the Kaiser Report, we'll be talking to Matt Taibbi. He's always a good one to have. He's speaking of robust reporting. He's got distribution in Rolling Stone. He says he's been a culturally important person during this financial crisis because it was his vampire squid wrapping its, you know, tentacles around the face of humanity that was a very important image that unified activists around the world and opinion around the world about the financial crisis, about Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, you've got Matt Taibbi at Rolling Stone and Michael Lewis with Vanity Fair, and those two outlets, which are not, you know, considered mainstream outlets. They're second tier outlets. Rolling Stone, certainly in the 60s and 70s with Hunter S. Thompson and with rock and roll being much more culturally significant at the time, was a much bigger presence than it is now. Vanity Fair, I think it had its biggest cultural impact in the 1930s, I think. You know, it's still around, and it's a bit of a lovey mosh pit. But Michael Lewis, who has done the best reporting of anybody, because he was working at Salomon Brothers during the whole John Goodfriend era, and he wrote that book Liar's Poker, which was really kicked off this entire era of exposés on Wall Street and banking and all the underhanded skullduggery that we've been reporting on. But these guys, you know, Matt Taibbi, when he goes on CNBC, occasionally, you know, they give him very short shift. And Michael Lewis, you know, he might go on Charlie Rose or something and talk for an hour, but I'm not sure. You know, he doesn't go on Bill Maher, you know, or something like that, you know, to get any kind of exposure, because there's a genuine fear of exposing these crimes, because it would be striking at the heart of what keeps that empire, that paper empire, in place.
You know, we only have a minute or two left, and I want to say that, you know, Michael Lewis is, of course, the only other American that I know that actually went and reported from Ireland and Greece and, you know, transmitted this story back to Americans of what was going on, the financial crimes going on there. You know, most Americans don't care about anything outside of their local little city. It's all very, you know, local there. They don't care about anything outside of the U.S. So at least I can't think of any other American reporter other than us that was out reporting from various hot spots across Europe and around the world relating to the whole financial system.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, also Iceland, he did a brilliant story in Iceland. And that's true. I guess he's out there and he goes to these places. He did an interesting story on Germany. His conclusion was that the Germans are naturally coprophagists, you know, that they eat their own feces or eat feces as a natural cultural trait, which meant that they were predisposed to eat the garbage bonds that were sold to them from Wall Street. That's kind of his conclusion. Which I think was maybe a bit of a stretch, but, you know, the Germans are strange in many ways.
Well, I'm assuming because they eat all the sausages, and that's from that area of a creature, and they...
Well, if you're going to get to... Then the French, I think, with their andouillette, which actually smells like fecal matter, and they are proud of it.
And, of course, the French have the bidet, but the Germans famously have the toilet built so that you can examine your fecal matter. So they
actually doesn't mean they eat it, like in France.
Well, with that profound thought there at the end, that's it for this episode of The Truth About Markets. And I'm very happy to be sharing it with our visitors to MaxKaiser.com, because there is a crowd of devout followers of The Truth About Markets. They're waiting for this show to be uploaded. I know Vonda Bra is like sitting there going, yes, 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 it's here.
Oh, yes, that's great. Huh? You know, we've been doing this for 8 years, I think. I think we've done, well, there's probably then more than 400 of these shows, more than 1,300 podcasts we've done.
Well, until next week.
Bye, y'all.